So, Kripke's so-called paradox of dogmatism is supposed to be a paradox of knowledge. It seems that Kripke first saw it more specifically as a paradox of two conceptions of knowledge that, rather disputably, he appears to consider more or less equivalent. The first one is the indefeasibilist view of knowledge, according to which one's knowing that P at T implied that no future evidence would lead one to lose one's knowledge at P, or more generally, to change one's mind, for instance, to fall into doubt on whether P. The second view is the infallibilist one, according to which, in order for one to know that P, one's grounds for one's belief that P must be conclusive. According to Rodrigo Borges, Kripke's intent was to show that the view according to which knowledge requires the elimination of all possibilities incompatible with what one knows leads to an absurd result, namely that if one knows that P, then one is rationally entitled to discount any evidence against P. End of quote. The paradox of dogmatism first appeared in an unpublished lecture delivered by Kripke to the Cambridge Moral Sciences Club, before it was published 40 years later in Kripke's Philosophical Troubles. Gilbert Harman transmitted the paradox as follows. If I know that H is true, I know that any evidence against H is evidence against something that is true, so I know that such evidence is misleading. So once I know that H is true, I'm in a position to disregard any future evidence that seems to tell against H. This is paradoxical, because I'm never in a position simply to disregard any future evidence, though I do know a great many different things. The paradox, to put it another way, consists in the idea that, and I quote Levi and Spectri in a recent paper, since the truth of P implies that evidence counter to P is misleading, knowing that P, one can also know by mere reflection that any counter evidence is misleading and thereby be absolutely warranted in disregarding evidence counting against what one believes. In Kripke's words, if I know something now, if I don't want to lose this knowledge, I should, as a rational agent, adopt a resolution not to allow any future evidence to overthrow it. But this doesn't seem to be our attitude towards statements that we know, nor does it seem to be a rational attitude. And if this attitude doesn't seem to be rational, this is because once knowing that P doesn't intuitively seem to put one in a position to know that any possible future evidence or pseudo-evidence against P would be misleading. The common sense view, says Kripke, is, for example, that you do know that I have written certain papers on model logic, but that future evidence could lead you to change your mind about this. So you should rationally leave yourself open to such changings of mind, even though it's the case that you know that I wrote these papers. The question is, why? So in order to answer this question, and so to solve the paradox, I shall first show that it's not a paradox of knowledge, nor a fortiori a paradox of indefeasibilist or infallibilist views of knowledge, but of belief. And, well, it's written here, I shall then advance the view of belief that makes the paradox disappear, and on the basis of this view, elucidate all believing that P, taking oneself to be fallible on whether P and being open-minded on whether P, are compatible and articulate. But I'm afraid I won't have time to say anything about that. So, let's start from a more formalized and detailed statement of the paradox than that of the previous section. It is indicated here. S knows that it is the case that P. This is an assumption. It is a truism that if it is the case that P, then any fact seeming to indicate or show that not P is misleading. S knows the truism that if it's the case that P, then any fact seeming to indicate or show that not P is misleading. Assumption. So by knowledge closure, if S knows that it's the case that P, and knows that if it's the case that P, then any fact seeming to indicate or show that not P is misleading, and on the basis of such knowledge, concludes that any fact seeming to indicate or to show that not B is misleading, S know that any fact seeming to indicate or show that not B is misleading. So, if one wants to believe the truth on whether P, it is rational for S to S may resolve to ignore as misleading any fact seeming to indicate or show that not P she might face in the future. And if S's sole doxastic aim is to believe the truth on whether P, S may resolve to ignore as useless or redundant any fact seeming to indicate or show that P she might face in the future. Correlatively, it's rational for S to resolve not to expose herself to new evidence relative to whether P, because at best, she won't lose something she already has, knowledge that P. But in short, it is rational for S to form the intention to avoid epistemic harm by closing her mind. This is a quote from Sosa. But intuitively, it's not rational for S to resolve to ignore as misleading any fact seeming to indicate or show that not P she might face in the future, nor to resolve not to expose herself to new evidence relative to whether P. Moreover, as Kukiri remarks, neither of these things seems to be our attitude toward future evidence in cases where we know something. So, seven step. The reason why this is irrational is intuitively that S doesn't know that any fact seeming to indicate or show that not P is misleading. Well, more precisely, as Iablo maintains, it may be that when it comes to certain specific propositions, a subject can know that. For instance, from my perceptually knowing that there is a computer in front of me now, it may be that I know that any fact seeming to indicate or show that not P I might face in the future would be misleading. In other words, there may be propositions such that it's all right to be dogmatic about them. But intuitively, it's false that for any proposition P, when a subject knows that P and knows that if it is the case that P, then any fact seeming to indicate or show that not P is misleading, she is in a position to know that any fact seeming to indicate or show that not P is misleading. So, last step, if the intuitions expressed in 5 and 6, premise 5 and 6, are to be respected, then if it is admitted that we know all sorts of things and that 2 is indisputably true, it seems that the only available option is to abandon the principle of epistemic closure upon which the inference from 1, 2, and 3 to 4 is based. As S.F. Sharon and Levi Spectre write, if closure is denied, the inference is invalid and the odd knowledge claim is avoided. In other words, the paradox seems to saddle us, they say, with a difficult choice between giving up the principle of epistemic closure and adhering to epistemic dogmatism of a particularly objectionable kind. Well, the first thing to note about this paradox is that infallibilist views of knowledge, according to which knowledge requires conclusive grounds or the elimination of all possibilities incompatible with what one knows, rather than specifically leading to the absurd result that if one knows that P, then one is rationally entitled to discount as any evidence against P, seem on the contrary to have the means to escape this absurd result. Suppose that none of our empirical beliefs satisfies the requirements of infallibilism, so that none of them amounts to knowledge, which is often thought to show that infallibilist views of knowledge lead to skepticism. It's easy to see why we are not entitled to disregard as misleading any fact seeming to indicate or show the falsity of our empirical beliefs that we might face in the future. Since we don't know the empirical things we ordinarily think we know, the principle of epistemic closure, combined with our knowledge of the truism that if it's the case that P, then any fact seeming to indicate or show that not P is misleading, doesn't entail that we know that any fact seeming to indicate or show the falsity of the things we ordinarily know is misleading. we ordinarily think we know is misleading, sorry. However, this way of escaping the absurd result comes at the price of implausibly denying that we have the ordinary knowledge we think we have. Suppose now that we have this knowledge. Whether or not it is infallible doesn't seem to make any difference with respect to the paradox. In order to see this, consider the following example designed by John Hawthorne. Suppose there are two newspapers, The Times and The Guardian, which I trust equally well for the purposes of obtaining soccer information. With good reason, both are extremely reliable in their reporting of soccer results. I look in The Times and find a Manchester United victory reported. I trust the report. The report is in fact correct. Under such circumstances, people are inclined to say that I know both that The Times said that Manchester United won and also that Manchester United won. Let's suppose I also know that The Guardian will have reported a result for the Manchester United game. I deduce either The Times and The Guardian correctly reported Manchester United victory, or else The Guardian made a mistake about the Manchester United result. Suppose, in fact, that unbeknownst to me, The Guardian did make such a mistake. People are not inclined to say, I know the above disjunction. So now consider these two returnings, L1, R1, and R2. John knows that Manchester United won the match, because John believes that Manchester United won the match satisfies certain specific conditions C. John knows the two reasons that if Manchester United won the match, Manchester United played the match. So John knows, on the basis of such knowledge, that Manchester United played the match. Another second returning, R2. John knows that Manchester United won the match, because John believes that Manchester United won the match satisfied certain specific conditions C. So same premise as in the first returning. Second premise, John knows the truism that if Manchester United won the match, those, whoever they are, and as numerous as they might be, who would say that Manchester United lost the match, would be wrong. So John knows, on the basis of such knowledge, that those, whoever they are, and as numerous as they might be, would say that Manchester United lost the match, would be wrong. While R1 seems perfectly all right, something clearly seems to go wrong with R2. While we have the intuition that 3 unproblematically follows from 1 and 2, we also have the intuition that it is incorrect to infer 3 star from 1 and 2 star. Since the first premise of both returnings is the same, since 2 and 2 star both consist in making the assumption that John knows something that is indisputably true, and since conclusions 3 and 3 star simply result from the application of the principle of epistemic closure, it cannot be argued, if our intuition is correct, that what is problematic in R2 comes from the conception of knowledge that is at work in premise one. If that were so, R1 would be just as problematic as R2, which is intuitively not the case. As a consequence, whether or not condition C or infallibility conditions shouldn't make any difference when it comes to the intuitive incorrectness of R2. So suppose that condition C are not infallibility conditions, but for instance, safety conditions. John knows that Manchester United won the match because the belief involved couldn't have easily been wrong or false given the way he formed it. 3 seems to unproblematically follow from 1 and 2, but we wouldn't say the same about 3 star and premise 1 and 2 star. From the safety of John's belief that Manchester United won the match, combined with John's knowing the truism stated in 2 star, it shouldn't intuitively be concluded that John knows, on the basis of such knowledge, that those, whoever they are, and as numerous as they might be, would say that Manchester United lost the match, would be wrong. Well, one might be inclined to think that this is because the fact that Jones believes that Manchester United won the match is safe doesn't exclude that this belief could be wrong. It simply excludes, by definition, that it could have easily been wrong, given the way it has been formed. So, one might go on, had Jones, knowing that Manchester United won the match, excluded that the belief in question could be wrong, it would have been unproblematic to conclude 3-star from assumption 1 and 2-star. But suppose now that conditions C are infallibility conditions, stating that a subject S knows that P only if S is believed that P, given its evidential basis, couldn't have been wrong. Imagine, for instance, that John has an epistemic guardian angel that inexorably and unbeknown to John prevents him from taking cognizance of incorrect or misleading accounts of football results that, were he aware of them, would lead him to form wrong beliefs about them. And we also prevents him from taking cognizance of correct and non-misleading accounts of football results when he is in a cognitive state or cognitive context in which he would badly process them and, as a result, form wrong beliefs about the results. So in short, suppose that it cannot happen that John takes cognizance of accounts of football results and on that basis form wrong beliefs about the results. As a consequence, according to the infallibilist, the belief he has formed by reading the Times that Manchester United won the match amounts to knowledge. But does this make R1 and R2 both unproblematic? Doesn't seem so. Even if Jones is infallible when he believes that Manchester United won the match, he clearly doesn't seem to be in a position to know that those, whoever they are, and as numerous as they might be, we would say that Manchester United lost the match, would be wrong. It therefore appears that the paradox doesn't come from John's fallibility when it comes to football results, because even if he is infallible about that, inferring 3-star from 1 and 2-star remains problematic. The fact that it seems that whatever one's view of knowledge, R1 will be correct and R2 incorrect, suggests that Kripke's paradox of dogmatism is not really a paradox of knowledge. This idea is reinforced by the observation that replacing knowledge by justification leads to the same result, this is R1 prime. John is justified in believing that Manchester United won the match because John's belief that Manchester United won the match satisfies certain specific conditions C, for instance, because it is rational or reasonable or permissible to believe that Manchester United won the match. John is justified in believing the truism that if Manchester United won the match, Manchester United played the match. So John is justified in believing, on the basis of these justified beliefs, that Manchester United played the match. Second reasoning. John is justified in believing that Manchester United won the match, etc. Same premise as in the former reasoning. John is justified in believing the truism that if Manchester United won the match, those, whoever they are, and as numerous as they might be, would say that Manchester United lost the match would be wrong. So John is justified in believing, on the basis of these justified beliefs, that those, whoever they are, and as numerous as they might be, would say that Manchester United lost the match would be wrong. Just as with knowledge, it seemed that whatever one's view of justification, R1 prime will be correct and R2 prime incorrect. For instance, from its being reasonable for John to believe that Manchester United won the match, and from its being at least reasonable for John to believe that if things are so, those who would say the contrary would be wrong, it shouldn't be concluded that it's reasonable for John to believe that they would be wrong. So, what's Kripke's paradox of dogmatism a paradox of? Should we claim that it is a paradox of knowledge and justification? In my opinion, the following two reasonings on the end out make it appear that this wouldn't give us this would give us an incomplete and misleading picture of the situation. So R1 double prime. John believes, for instance, by reading the Times, that Manchester United won the match. If one believes that P, one is committed to believing what follows from P. From Manchester United's having won the match, it followed that Manchester United played the match. So, by believing that Manchester United won the match, John is committed to believing that Manchester United played the match. And now, R2 double prime. John believes, by reading the Times, that Manchester United won the match. If one believes that P, one is committed to believing what follows from P, whatever the epistemic status of one's beliefs at P. From Manchester United having won the match, it followed that those, whoever they are and as numerous as they might be, would say that Manchester United lost the match would be wrong. So, by believing that Manchester United won the match, John is committed to believing that those, whoever they are and as numerous as they might be, would say that Manchester United lost the match would be wrong. Once again, the conclusion of the first of these two reasonings seems perfectly correct, contrary to that of the second. And once again, the question is how to account for this difference. In the case of these last two reasonings, the question is more specifically how to account for this difference, since the first two premises are identical, since 3 double prime and 3 star double prime are both indisputably true, and since the conclusion in both cases follows from the shared premise 2 double prime. Well, what's interesting in this pair of reasonings is that, contrary to the previous ones, rather than merely leading us to the idea that there must be something wrong with the principle of epistemic closure, whether of knowledge closure or justification closure, whose rejection seems to be the only way to escape the strongly counterintuitive conclusion 3-star and 3-star prime, it indicates the direction in which to find the source of what's wrong with this principle, provided it is admitted that the three pairs of reasonings I have mentioned are all instances of one and the same paradox, which intuitively seems to be the case. Indeed, in order to escape the conclusion 4-star double prime, the only option is to reject 2 double prime. That is, the claim that if one believes that P, one is committed to believe what follows, to believing what follows from P. But what could be wrong with this claim? In order to see this, let's consider another reasoning. So it's R3 double prime. John believes that Manchester United won the match. If one believes that P, one is committed to believing what follows from P. From Manchester United's having won the match, it followed that the world isn't peopled only with one evil demon and systematically deceived BIVs. So, by believing that Manchester United won the match, John is committed to believing that the world isn't peopled only with one evil demon and systematically deceived BIVs. What's striking here is that inferring 4 double star double prime from 1 double prime, 2 double prime, and 3 double star double prime doesn't seem to be clearly incorrect, contrary to inferring 4 star double prime from 1 double prime, 2 double prime, and 3 star double prime. This indicates, in my opinion, that we cannot explain why the latter inference is incorrect, contrary, for instance, to the inference in which R1 double prime consists, by arguing that that Manchester United played the match is part of the content of the beliefs that John has formed by reading the Times that Manchester United won the match. While that those who would say that Manchester United lost the match would be wrong isn't part of this belief. Indeed, that the world isn't peopled only with one evil demon and systematically deceived BIVs isn't arguably part of that belief formed by reading the Times. ever. But it nonetheless seems to be all right to say that by believing that Manchester United won the match, John is committed to believing that the world isn't peopled only with one evil demon and systematically deceived behaviors. So why, by believing that Manchester United won the match, is John not committed to believing that those who would say that Manchester United lost the match would be wrong, while by so believing is committed to believing that Manchester United played the match and to believing that the world isn't peopled only with one evil demon and systematically deceived BIVs? The answer, I would suggest, is that John isn't committed to believing this because even if it follows from what he believes that Manchester United won the match, that those who would say that Manchester United lost it would be wrong, believing this wouldn't merely consist in believing something that John takes to be a consequence of what he believes. Believing this would entail, in addition and indissociably, revising his initial doxastic attitude vis-à-vis the proposition that Manchester United won the match. More specifically, believing this would entail revising his initial doxastic attitude vis-à-vis the proposition in question if this attitude wasn't that of certainty vis-à-vis the proposition that Manchester United won the match, which is nothing other, in my opinion, than the attitude of taking oneself to be infallible on this issue. Now, I would argue one cannot be committed to entertain vis-à-vis proposition P as the result of one's having a certain doxastic attitude D vis-à-vis that proposition, another doxastic attitude than D vis-à-vis that proposition. Right. Well, I'm not entirely satisfied by this way of putting things, but I hope this can enable you to grasp the idea I have in mind. This is why, in my opinion, R2 double prime is incorrect, while R1 double prime and R3 double prime are not. For instance, if John believes that Manchester United won the match, John is committed to believing that the world isn't peopled only with one evil demon and systematically deceived behaviors, because first condition, the latter thing follows from the former, and because second condition, believing the latter thing doesn't entail revising his initial doxastic attitude vis-à-vis the proposition that Manchester United won the match, supposing this attitude wasn't that of certainty but of belief. And the same goes for R1 double prime. Okay, quickly. In connection with this tentative idea, consider the following three reasoning. John believes that Manchester United won the match. John believes the truism that if Manchester United won the match, Manchester United played the match. So John believes, on the basis of these two beliefs, that Manchester United played the match. Second reasoning, John believes that Manchester United won the match. John believes the truism that if Manchester United won the match, those who would say that Manchester United lost the match would be wrong. So John believes, on the basis of these two beliefs, that Zeus would say that Manchester United lost the match would be wrong. And third reasoning, John believes that Manchester United won the match. John believes that if Manchester United won the match, the world isn't peopled only with one evil demon and systematically deceived BIVs. So John believes, on the basis of these two beliefs, that the world isn't peopled only with one evil demon and systematically deceived BIVs. Only the conclusion of R2 triple prime seems implausible. That of R3 triple prime, for instance, doesn't seem to be problematic if it's not interpreted as saying that John takes the two beliefs in question to be a reason for him to believe that the world isn't peopled only with one evil demon and systematically deceived BIVs. But if John were certain that Manchester United won the match, and so took himself to be infallible on this issue, and didn't merely believe that Manchester United won the match, three-star double triple prime wouldn't be implausible. And it would simply be preferable to state this conclusion by saying, sojourn is certain on the basis of, etc., rather than sojourn believes on the basis of, etc. And the same goes, ceteris paribus, with R2 double prime. Replace believe in this reasoning by is certain, and everything's fine. So to conclude, I would like to briefly indicate how to characterize the attitude of being certain that P, that I have distinguished from believing that P. More specifically, I would like to indicate all believing that P without having any doubt that P, that is, all fully believing that P, can be distinguished from being certain that P. Well, the idea I would suggest is that to fully believe that P is to believe, or to fully believe, that non-misleading evidence that not P won't be faced in the future. Not that logically, physically, or metaphysically, this cannot happen. In other words, when I fully believe that P, I fully believe that logically, physically, or metaphysically, I could face non-misleading evidence that P, but that this won't happen. As such, from one's fully believing something, one cannot draw any conclusions about the attitude one should have vis-à-vis any future evidence. Fully believing that I won't be faced with non-misleading evidence that not P isn't believing that if this were to happen, I would be misled since this cannot happen. Believing that this cannot happen, that I couldn't face non-misleading evidence that not P, and not only that this won't happen, is, I would suggest, being certain that P. It therefore appears that fully believing that something is the case doesn't imply that one has, vis-à-vis possible future evidence that not P, the dogmatic attitude that one would have if fully believing that P was identical to being certain that P. It is true, however, that fully believing that P closes one's inquiry about whether P. As per Holt, one cannot have no real doubts that P, and at the same time takes the question of whether P to remains open. But I would say that it is not really detrimental to one's personally tracking the truth or to scientific inquiry, because of one's being constantly exposed to new evidence, whether or not this is what one wants, and because of the high interconnectedness of beliefs. Thank you.